Welcome to the Heartstrong Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Lindbergh. Like many of you, I'm living a life that I just did not expect. And over the years, I've come to value the idea of living heartstrong, of growing through the challenges in my life, and let's face it, the challenges in our times. And I'm on a mission to help you do the same. So each week, I talk to thought leaders, authors, experts, and everyday amazing people who have something to teach us all about living fully amidst our struggles. I have learned so much from others along my journey, and so I hope that my guests will help you on yours. Let's get started. Today, I am thrilled to welcome Ryan Mannion to the podcast. Ryan serves as the president of the Travis Mannion Foundation, one of the leading veteran service organizations in the country. Ryan leads a movement focused on assisting veterans and families of the fallen to take the next step in their personal journeys and to inspire the next generation of leaders. Ryan is the co-author of The Knock at the Door, in which she shares her personal story of grief and how she moved forward to be the best version of herself. She's also the host of the Resilient Life podcast, where her guests discuss their experiences with resilience and how they've turned their challenges into opportunities for growth. Ryan is for certain an advocate with an incredibly brave spirit, and she and I are on a similar mission to build resilient humans. So I am super excited to share this time with you today. Welcome, Ryan, to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited. There's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but I want to start talking about the Travis Mannion Foundation, which is an obvious, which I know was originally started by your mother. And so I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about your mom and Travis and how it all came to be.
Sure. So I grew up in a military family. My dad is a retired Marine Corps colonel, and probably unsurprisingly, my brother followed in his footsteps. He went to the United States Naval Academy and then commissioned into the Marine Corps in 2004. Travis was killed on his second deployment to Iraq in 2007. And, you know, after his death, my mom was a military spouse. And those that are familiar with the military community, you know, military spouses have a tough job. I would say perhaps the toughest, because when you serve in the military, you basically experience a series of deployments or new locations. And every 2 years in my childhood, we moved. I used to hate it at the time. I think it has actually made me more resilient as an individual now that I'm older. So I appreciate it. But my mom, as a young mother and wife, was never given the opportunity to explore her own community, her own passions, her own career. And so everywhere we moved, she kind of had to start all over again. So my mom was the teacher's aide. She was the receptionist at the dentist's office. You know, she took odd jobs wherever we went. And it was after my brother died, my mom wanted to start an organization in his name to really, at the time, continue his legacy. She was grieving the death of her only son, and she wanted to make sure that his name lived on. And she started the Travis Mannion Foundation, and my family and I, my husband, my father and I, really saw it as a way for her to be able to channel her grief. And I'll say, admittedly, we didn't think that it would become much, but we thought it was a good outlet for her. And it was the first time I saw her be able to be passionate about something that she knew wasn't going to go away, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she had this opportunity to honor her son by helping others. And I say much to our surprise, but really not much to our surprise, because my mom was such a tenacious woman. She took a small family memorial fund in the Philadelphia area and, you know, launched it into this national movement, which was incredible to watch on the sidelines. I actually didn't join the Travis Mannion Foundation officially until several years after Travis's death. I was on the board, but it was my mom running the show. And it was amazing to see what she had created in her son's name. And as she moved forward, she began to realize that you know, personally for her, it was important to continue Travis's legacy. But even more than that, she started to realize the impact she was having on the military community, the work that she was doing with families of the fallen and with returning veterans. So it was pretty incredible to watch. She was diagnosed with cancer a little under 5 years after Travis was killed. And, you know, I'll never forget the day she was diagnosed with cancer. And really diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And, you know, they told her that she had about 8 months to live, even with treatments. And the day after receiving that news, she woke up, she got dressed, and she went into the office at the Travis Manning Foundation. Like, that's how important it was for her. And she went there every day and worked up until the last few weeks of her life. And died of cancer just a few days short of my brother's 5-year anniversary.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. I can attest to a mother's tenacity and love, you know, for their kids. It sounds like she is the epitome of that. So, you know, you said in your book, I think you used the words, I wrote them down, like, quote unquote, coping mechanism. That's what you and your dad kind of thought her starting the foundation was. What do you think was like the tipping point? Like, what was the thing that she did, or when it's, I don't know, something that happened where you're like, okay, this has got a life that's bigger. This isn't just about Travis or our family, but this is something that this community desperately needs and is like gravitating towards.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that that she did was she thought very big, right? And almost to the point where when she would have these ideas, you would kind of say, well, that's not super attainable. Like, for instance, one of the first things we did as an organization is we had, we called it the 9/11 Heroes Run. So at first, when we were trying to get our feet wet and identify what we were going to do, we knew we had momentum to raise money. So we were like, okay, we're going to raise money and kind of figure it out along the way. And we decided to have a 5K run in our local town right outside of Philadelphia. 9/11 was approaching, and we hosted the 9/11 Heroes Run. And so it was a 5K to honor all of those who had served and sacrificed on 9/11 and in the war since. And we had about 500 people that came out to that first 5K, which I was like blown away.
That's impressive.
Oh my God, there's 500 people here. Like, this is amazing. And, you know, my dad and I were like, this is unbelievable. And I remember having a conversation after the run, and we talked about like how we could potentially grow this run to 1,000 people. Like, could you imagine? And my mom said, well, I want to have one of these runs in every city across the country. And I envision this run being the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure for our military and first responder community. And it was like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. But, you know, right away from there, she was like on the phone, like, who can I identify to help lead a race here, here, and here? And the next year she had 2 races. And then the third year she had 15 races.
Oh my gosh.
And here we are today in 2021, we had 90 races across the world and had over 60,000 participants. So, you know, it was, I think the idea is like, she dreamed really big. And for a lot of us, it's sometimes we become, we put like fear into obtaining our dreams, right? Like, we
totally
think, like, that's unachievable. I mean, I still do it today. I'm always very risk adverse. Like, I don't know. Like, what if it doesn't work? Right. And so she was one that was like, what's the worst that's going to happen? Right. So she just went for it. And I think having that sort of spirit combined with the idea that, you know, before my brother left for his second deployment to Iraq, he was at a Eagles game, a football game with my husband. And my husband jokingly said, you know, as they were leaving the game, why don't you let me push you down the stairs and maybe you won't have to go back to Iraq. And Travis turned to my husband and he said, you know, if I don't go back to Iraq, then somebody much less prepared is going to go in my place. If not me, then who? And my husband shared that story with a reporter from the Inquirer after Travis's death. And I remember the front page of the Inquirer came out and it just said, you know, if not me, then who? Travis Mannion. And it was this article about that moment. And those five words became like our rally cry for our organization. And I think that people responded to that. In with everything, right? And so now it is the mantra for everything that we do. Like, it's five words that each and every one of us can incorporate into our own lives. And like, here was a 25-year-old kid that was going back to Iraq, and that was the answer he gave. So, you know, I think that combined with like that idea combined with my mom's tenacity was really what kind of put everything into place and really pushed us to where we were going to go.
Yeah. It's like the fuel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I love that. I read that story in your book and I love that mantra. I mean, I think it's incredible for a lot of reasons, because I think it really, it's like, I'm owning this. You know, I think we live in a world where people don't want to own stuff. And it's like, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? Because I think we live in a place where a lot of people want everyone else to do something, you know? And I just love that. I think it's just something that I identify with. You know, I'm not a military family, but I'm like, oh yeah, I can, that's right. And it made me think of a story. So when my son was really young and in the hospital, we had spent months next to another family who's also, their kid was there too. And he was very sick. And the mom came back one day to the hospital and she's like, you know, I was talking to my husband last night and I was just really pissed off about how sick my son is. And I was angry. And I said, why me? Why me? Why me? And she goes, and he looked at me and he said, why not you? Yeah. He's like, why not our family? And when I read that story in your book, it made me think of this family that I had spent so much time with. And I remember when she said to me that day, I was like, oh, wow. You know, I never thought of it that way. But I also agree that like, it's a privilege to even go through this stuff, because you get, you know, kind of a spark in you that is a gift, right? And your mom had that. Like, she is a woman after my own heart. I love the way that she thought. Well, that's amazing. You do a lot of really interesting work to me. I mean, just having a nonprofit myself and working this and observing a lot of other organizations, I really love the service component that you have. I think helping others serve is very important on a lot of levels. But you do something to inspire character in the next generation. And I'm just curious about that program and like what you do, because I think that's super vital in our culture today, for young people especially. I really admire that. Could you share a little bit about what you guys do and how that's sort of grown also?
Sure. So, you know, by nature, we are a veteran service organization. So we provide leadership, professional and personal leadership programs to returning veterans, to families of the fallen, all in ways to engage them, to bring them into a community, and to help them successfully transition. And one of the things that, and again, you know, going back when I said, you know, at first we were just kind of raising money and trying to figure out like what place we wanted to have within the veteran space. When my mom wrote our, you know, you have a nonprofit, so you fill out that 501c3 paperwork. And at the time, we had no idea what running a nonprofit was about. So it was like, okay, who's your board of directors? It was me, my mom, my dad, and my aunt. And then it was like, what's your mission statement? And so my mom wrote a mission statement down, our original mission statement was to provide support to returning veterans and families of the fallen, and to play a part in helping to create the next generation of leaders. Wow. And I remember being like, that's a little bit like, that's a little bit all over the place. Like, how are we going to accomplish that bold mission? Like, there's a lot going on there. Right. And, at the time she didn't really know, but she was like, that's what I want to do. So I'm putting that as our mission. We kind of knew the things that we could do with the military community, but that secondary piece, it was like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So, out of a, I'll tell the backstory of how that program began. I was actually asked to speak at my brother's high school. A few years after his death, they said, you know, we'd love for you to come in and just share Travis's story. He went to an all boys Catholic high school right outside of Philadelphia. And they said, you know, we want these young men to know the story of Travis Mannion. They, you know, when you pull into the school, that the road that you pull into, they've renamed If Not Me, Then Who Boulevard. It's wow. Like they really embraced Travis and his spirit, and they wanted these kids to know about him. So they had asked me to give a speech, and I remember kind of, it was the first time I really spoken publicly to a large group, and I was terrified. And I remember I wrote a speech. Like, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go in and talk. Mm-hmm. I wrote a speech, like memorized it word for word. And as I was putting that speech together, it, you know, they had asked me to speak about Travis, but I kept thinking, I could hear Travis in my head saying, stop talking about me, you know? And so I took what I wrote and I incorporated other stories. So stories of service members and Marines that he served with that did come home, because I didn't want it to be all about like Travis went to war and he died. I wanted them to know like the spirit of our men and women that serve in uniform, and they come back and they're incredible assets to our society. And so I shared those types of stories. And then I wanted to talk about leadership a little bit. And I found this great story of George Washington, which is, you know, very common, but this idea that, you know, the idea of George Washington's leadership was that his ultimate act in leadership is that he stepped back from being the leader and said, you know, I'm retiring to Mount Vernon. It's time for someone else to take the helm. And so I thought that was such a great way to tell these kids, like, it's not about your title or your position, right? That's not what leadership's about. So I went in, I gave that speech, and, you know, didn't deviate a word from my memorized speech. And I actually read the speech to my dad beforehand. And I remember him saying like, yeah, this is great. Cause he was with me. He was like, it's not all about Travis. Right. And so he's like, I love the different examples. He's like, and I love that George Washington story. It's really a great story. So I go in, I give the speech, and afterwards the principal came up to me and he's like, you know, this message really resonated, and I would love to talk to other schools in the area and invite them, because, you know, it wasn't just about one person. It was this kind of like idea about leadership and character. And he said, would you be open to speaking at other schools? And I'm like, I'd love to. Like, I loved it. When I stood up there, I was like, I love this. And I said, but get some feedback from the kids. I want to know like what parts they really liked, what parts, was there anything they didn't like? And so a few days later, he called me and he said, you know, I talked with the kids and like, they obviously love hearing about Travis, like somebody who walked the halls of this high school. They loved hearing the stories of the other service members, like just hearing stories of our men and women in uniform. And I said, well, was there anything they didn't like? And he said, you know, the one feedback I got is that they didn't love that George Washington story. And I thought it was so funny because my dad, that was the one part my dad was like, that's such a great story, you know? And what I realized is that like our next generation is looking for relevant and relatable models of leadership. And so with that, our Character Does Matter program was born. And so what we do is we actually train veterans to go out and deliver their stories to our nation's youth. And we actually train our veterans in character development. So they are trained to deliver character development to our next generation. So these kids are getting a dose of character and leadership, what it means to live with integrity and courage. And in the same token, our veterans are able to come back and share their stories with the communities in which they live. So it's you know, it benefits both sides. I would say more so, you know, the veterans that are a part of this program, and we've done a ton of research and data with Syracuse University, they are thriving because they feel connected to their community. They feel like they have an outlet to express themselves, and they feel like they are still given the opportunity to serve. So when they take that uniform off, that desire to serve doesn't go away. And so at the Travis Manning Foundation, that's what we want to offer. We want to offer not just veterans, because our community at our organization is made up of veterans and civilians. Mm-hmm. So it is really, you know, anybody can get involved in our organization. And we have found that the best way to be the best version of yourself is to serve others. So the program, you know, we've brought the program to over 500,000 students across the country. We have thousands of veterans that deliver the program to schools, sports teams, youth groups. And it's just awesome to see from that first speech. Again, when you talk about grassroots, like we really figured it out along the way.
Along the way. That's such a good point. I think, you know, sometimes when you pull something off and everybody's like, wow, that's really great. They didn't know that, like, you were sitting in your car coming up with it 5 minutes before, you know, or that you, and I mean, I've experienced that so many times. You're like, oh, that was so great. And you're like, oh, that actually almost didn't just happen, you know? So I think that I love that backstory, because I think it also shows that if you have an idea, like, you can bring it to life. You don't have to have all the answers right away. You just have to try.
Yeah.
And that's something. And I love what you said about service, because I know in my own experience, like, sometimes you can't even take in, like, the gravity of your own story, but you can serve somebody else. Like, and I've seen that in so many families in the communities that I'm a part of. They have this story, this experience that's, like, so significant. It's changed their whole life. And even though they haven't, like, addressed their own grief or their own stuff that they need to give, they're not ready yet, but they are ready to, like, to give to others. And it is, I mean, I know in my own life and my own family, for my husband and I, it's been a super healing thing for us. And I love that you shared that, because, you know, we live, I also observe, like, we have all this self-help and all this positivity, which is all good stuff, but I think it stops short because it's not supposed to be just about you. You know, I think people miss that. And I love how you guys take that to the next level of saying it's about community, right? It's not just about us. And so you said that you're doing this all over the country. You're bringing veterans and you're training them, so they're getting the skills that they need and the confidence to kind of deliver these. So you have, like, a standard, I guess, for this education.
We do. Yeah. So veterans we have a ton of programs for veterans at the organization, but this one specifically, you do have to go through a training program to be equipped and ready to, you know, work with kids and to deliver character education. The service component to everything that we do is this idea that, you know, you've lost people that are very close to your child, you know, I mean, the worst and loss that you could ever imagine. I watched my mom, who lost her son, heal through service to others. Yeah. So I know how powerful that is. And I think you touched on it, such a great point, that it's about getting out of kind of your own crap, right?
Yeah. Totally.
And not doing this, like, pity party for yourself, because you can think no one has it as bad as me. And I remember when Travis died, like, the first thing I said, the first words out of my mouth when Travis died were, "It's not fair."
Totally.
And, you know, absolutely, to me, it wasn't fair.
Yeah.
But when you look at the atmosphere around, like, there's so many people it's not fair to, the circumstances they're in, the hands that they're dealt. And so for us to be able to go out and say, like, I'm going to take my loss, my tragedy, and I'm going to use it to do for others, like, that's the greatest healer that you could possibly have. And I always say, like, service is actually a selfish action, because nobody who serves doesn't get something from it. Like, there is no unselfish act of service. But that's okay. It's okay for it to be a selfish act, but know going into it, you're going to benefit just as much, if not more, than to those you're serving. So we use that as our method and our recipe for how we work with our families of the fallen. You know, that's what we do with them. We take them to serve. Like, if you want to be a part of our organization and you lost your loved one in service to this country, we are not going to give you a bunch of self-help books and put you in a room and have you talk about your feelings and bring in a psychiatrist. And, you know, and there are, and I'm not saying there's not a place for that kind of stuff,
sure, of
but
course.
Our organization operates in, we're going to help you heal by giving back to others.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's super powerful. And it also brings people into community, which I also think is something that I've always admired about the military. And observed in other people that, you know, we've had friends go to the academies and, you know, our good friends that are neighbors and just listen to their stories. And I remember one day I was outside the ICU where my son was, and you know, when you're together with any group of people for a long period of time, going through something, going through the highs and the lows, and you're in this sort of enclave that most people don't even know exists in the world, like you get close to people, you know, you yeah. might be have really different walks of life, but you can sit down and have a drink with them and you just don't even need to say a word, you know, and that's something that's really cool. And I was standing there with my dad, looked at me one day and he's like, you know, these are like your war buddies. Like he said, it kind of, and I was like, kind of didn't, but I thought about that and I was like, you're so right. And there are people through my experience that, you know, I experienced things with them and saw things that most people don't ever see and will never experience or want to see. Mm-hmm. And it's a bond that you build. And it's in even through all these years, one of the gift of Ethan's life is like, and doing the work that we do is we know people everywhere, which I'm sure you do too. And it's awesome. And it's a gift to like have all these relationships. And I just think like we're living in a world where there's such a like so much loneliness. I just read this article in the Wall Street Journal about middle-aged women are like lonelier than ever, you know, disconnected, and how important it is to be serving and being part of a community. Like, and that is something that I think people are looking for.
Yeah, I think everybody's looking for that. I mean, yeah. the military creates community. They create yeah. camaraderie. They create brotherhood and sisterhood with mm-hmm. those they serve alongside with, especially in these last 20 years with many of our troops, you know, being on the front lines, serving overseas, that bond was even greater. And mm-hmm. when you take that away, that is a huge component, I think, to the mental health decline that's happening in our country mm-hmm. right now. And yeah. you know, I mean, the last 2 years have been hard. We are very much an organization that thrives on in-person, like mm-hmm. events, getting people together, getting people active. And so, you know, we've obviously had to flex over the last 2 years. We're seeing that light at the end of the tunnel. And mm-hmm. we went back to in-person events, probably much to the dismay of many people, thinking we maybe pulled the trigger too early, but it was that important to us to weigh the benefit, the risks and the benefits of, mm-hmm. you know, people getting into a place that like they couldn't get out of mentally and yeah. saying, we're going to weigh that risk versus getting you outside and taking the chances of COVID because it's mm-hmm. that important. And so yeah. that's how we've operated as an organization. And I think that's how I operate as an individual. Like it's this kind of risk versus safety mentality, but understanding that there's like really, really severe risks for this isolation that's happening. And our society thrives off of, you know, social media and mm-hmm. being behind a screen, and it just doesn't work. Like no. we are not designed to live that way. And that's why I think you see a lot of the issues that are happening across the country, across the world, frankly.
Yeah. No, I could not agree with you more. I think it is. And I mean, similarly, like we have had to cancel events and, you know, people, someone said to me the other day, they're like, I just want to get in a room with people, you know, like they just want to get back to that community. And that is really important. And, you know, just what you said is such a good reminder to me, even that continuing to cultivate that really, really matters, and to lead that, because people are looking for people to lead that, you know, to organize the things that they want to show up to. So that's so good. So I started following you, I think it's August of 2021, when we were withdrawing from Afghanistan. And I've always been like a student of politics in the world, just an interest of mine. My grandfather was a Navy corpsman in World War II, and you know, he was actually in a really significant battle, and very few people lived. So my dad always says, "It's just a statistical miracle that we're even here." Like he always reminds us of that. Like it's amazing that we're here. And And I think my grandfather really inspired me because he was just such a person of, he just continued. Like, he went through a lot of stuff. He saw a lot of hard things that he rarely spoke of, but he was such a person. He just persevered, you know? And I think that, so anyways, I've always been interested in that. And so I started following you when you were helping different people, you know, get out of Afghanistan, especially interpreters. And it became real to me because a good friend of ours served in Afghanistan. And when all that was going down, he texted us a picture of his translator that he had worked with, who was with him the whole time of his deployment. And what once he left Afghanistan, had gotten word that his throat had been slashed by the Taliban and that he had been killed. And, you know, I was actually just speaking to him and his wife about this the other day. And I said, you know, what was his dream? Like, what was your translator? Like, why did he get involved with you guys? Like, what was the, you know, he's like, he wanted to come to the United States. He's like, he was a highly educated person. He spoke three languages. He was really, you know, an accomplished person. And he wanted to put the war behind him at some point and have that opportunity to go to the United States. So that, you know, I think in the world, we love to talk about issues. We forget about the people. And yeah. he was a person. I was looking at his picture. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about, you know, what that experience was like. I know you're getting texts from people and you were coordinating. And I will tell you, like, just watching from a screen across Instagram, I was like, this woman was made for this. Like, for this moment, she was created for this. I just felt like you were. And so I'd love to just tell me a little bit about, and the listeners, like, what that time was like and what all went down and, you know, where people are today.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy because, you know, Travis didn't serve in Afghanistan. He served two deployments in Iraq, and actually Travis's interpreter, my brother wrote a recommendation for him to receive his, special immigrant visa just days before Travis was killed. His name was Mustafa, and Travis was killed in April, and that January, we spent New Year's Eve in our home with Mustafa. Mm-hmm. He changed his name to Nick when he came here. and I've maintained a close relationship and friendship with Nick. He lives in Florida. He's, you know, and he's forever grateful, for, you know, Travis's friendship and brotherhood when he was over there. Yeah. And I saw the bond between the two of them. And, you know, so I understood the bond that was happening with those allies, you know, Iraqi or Afghan allies and our service members. You know, when I started the Travis Manning, when I took over for the Travis Manning Foundation in 2012, and, you know, I obviously share a lot on social media about the work mm-hmm. that I do. And I had received a Facebook message on my public Facebook page from Bashamal. He was, a contractor with the American Army, for 8 years, along with his brother. And, he wrote me this really nice note on Facebook and just said, you know, I lost my brother to the Taliban. So his brother was, worked with the American Army and was killed by the Taliban. And he said, so, you know, I too share the loss of losing a brother. And kind of shared his story and shared what your friend said, like his ultimate goal was to come to America one day. And mm-hmm. he was going through the process of, getting his visa and needed some, really had reached out and was like, do you know how to connect me with this person? And just by chance, I was able to find the person on LinkedIn. So mm-hmm. anyway, helped him identify and he got all his paperwork together. And, you know, we talked here and there. Right. And so we got all his paperwork together. And, the last I knew, his paperwork was complete. And I was like, oh, great. Maybe this guy will come to America one day. Right. And then Afghanistan like collapses overnight. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I thought was, oh my gosh, I wonder if Bashamal ever made it out. Hmm. And so I shot him a text and I said, hey, did you ever make it out of Afghanistan? And he wrote back like, no, I'm still in hell. Wow. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so, you know, I had no idea what I could do at that point. I mean, if you were watching on the news, you saw it was like pandemonium, right? Yeah. And so I took to my small following on social media and I'm like, I don't know, let me just see what happens. And so I put it out and I'm like, hey, I've got a friend in Afghanistan. Does anybody know how to help get him out? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the power of the military community, I yeah. had like, you know, 20 different Marines that were like, wow. I've got a guy there. I got connected with an Air Force captain or an Air Force major who was at the gates in Kabul at the airport. And I mean, we devised this plan where he said, listen, I'll help your friend put up. He had me write a name, had them write a name on a sign, told them to go to the airport at 3 a.m. And in a crowd of 30,000, this guy, Jared, found Bashamal, his wife, his three-year-old son, and his brother, Muhammad, holding up a sign and pulled them through the gate. And it was like an unbelievable moment because they had been in this crowd for probably close to 8 or 9 hours. And it was 90 something degrees. Yeah. And Bashamal, the last text I got from him before I knew they had made it through, he had sent me a picture of his three-year-old son, Atal. And he was like sweating profusely. Oh. He did not look good. And he said, I'm getting worried about Atal. And I was like, I got to tell him to turn around, just go back home. Like, I don't want anything to happen to this little boy. And not 5 minutes later, I got a text from Jared and he just wrote, I have him. Wow. And I was like, oh my God. Because I was putting my story out on social media and I shared it, next thing you know, I have like Afghans that are writing me on every platform. They've got my number. They're texting me on WhatsApp.
Oh my gosh.
Like, oh my gosh. So I just felt like compelled. I'm like, well, it worked. And so I went back to Jared. I'm like, can we try this again? And he's like, let's do it. Wow. So the next night we had 30 Afghans holding up a sign and we did it for three more nights and we got over 120 people through those gates with this, like, I mean, everybody's like, how did you do it? I'm like, we had them write on a piece of cardboard with a 4-inch pole. I mean, it wasn't anything like overly complicated, but it worked. And but so, it worked. It was incredible. And like, it, you know, even last night I got a text from, and I don't even know who it was because I didn't know these people. Bashamal was my friend. I didn't know these people. But last night I got a text on WhatsApp and it was like, just wanted you to know I'm now settled in Utah. Thank you so much. Oh, I have no idea who it was, but I was like, that's great. You know? And so, I kept saying this whole time, like, I felt like if I could do something, I was going to do it. And somehow we had figured out this little way and it was working. So we kept doing it. And it was actually the last night we did it was the night before the explosion at the airport.
Okay.
And and that night, Jared said, this is the last time, it's getting too dangerous. And the next morning was the explosion at the airport. And, you know, everything was halted from there. But I now have... Bashamal lives less than a mile down the street from me with his brother, his wife, and three-year-old son. Him and his brother work at the Travis Mannion Foundation, leading our Afghan resettlement efforts. We're working now with Afghan families to help them resettle. And though we're a veteran service organization, our veterans that serve along with us, like, they want to make sure that our Afghan allies are taken care of. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest thing for me. When you talk about community, you know, you saw so much about Afghanistan and what was happening and, you know, people were pissed and I was pissed because these were men and women that served, well, men mostly, that served alongside our U.S. forces for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And in doing so, we made them a commitment 20 years ago that we would help them to come to the United States. Like they knew when serving that was the light at the end of the tunnel, that they could come here and thrive as individuals, as citizens. And we didn't honor that commitment to these people. But I'll tell you what, like our veterans were working their asses off, you know, in underground operations to get these people to safety. And so it's still, I posted yesterday, you know, there are so many that are still over there that were
that
with special immigrant visas that aren't going to be honored. And it breaks me because I still get messages today from people saying, please, can you help me? We're still here. And, you know, I don't know what I can do at this point. Yeah. But I take comfort in knowing that I now have, like, my family has been extended by four, like Bashamal, and they're my family now. And I've shared, since they've been here, I've shared every holiday with them. they're at my house or I'm at their house every other day. So, you know, it's beautiful in that way, but it's also heartbreaking to know that, like you said, when you put the human, like, there are still people with children over there living their lives in fear.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, that whole point of making a commitment to people, right? And I think that's why, at least from what way I observed, it was so hard even for the military community that I knew for the whole thing to be happening, because those were real people to them. You know, they committed to them and saw them. And so, yeah, I think that that story is super incredible. And I just applaud you for your courage and for the, you know, person that was actually on the ground and his courage, you know, to do that. And I think that's sometimes what it takes. Like, you have to just, and I have learned that you just sometimes have to say, I believe in this and I'm going to make it happen or figure out how to make it happen. And I'll go down swinging either way. Right.
Yeah.
And I love that, because I think that that is the human spirit. That's community, like, in action. That's
amazing. I mean, for me, listen, I didn't do much. I was, other than losing, like, staying up for about 48 hours straight, like, I was here. I was in the comfort of my own home. You know, Jared was on the ground, willing to lose his career, because what he was doing was not, you know, he was breaking a lot of protocols to do what he was doing, but he just kept saying, like, I could not just stand there and watch people up against this gate and not help them. It took a lot of courage and bravery on his end. So
is he back in the States now, Jared?
He is.
Yeah. He is.
And we actually in December, he lives in Georgia in December, him and his wife. And I never met him. I didn't know him.
Yeah.
I just start texting this guy. I'm like, hey, can you help? You know? But in December he came to our place, and Bashamal Muhammad came over, and he was able to see them again.
Wow.
In the States. And so it was awesome. Awesome reunion.
Wow. That's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing that. That's awesome. You know, in talking about all the things we just discussed, I was thinking about the veterans community and the families of the fallen. And, you know, what do you think? Well, I'm going to go backtrack a second. You said something in your book. You said men and women in uniform fight for a nation, for a set of ideals that are bigger than themselves. They stand guard over their fellow Americans' rights to vote, pray, learn, and love in safety. And you wrote in another point in the book that, you know, Travis was fighting for these ideals, not for a political party, a specific president, that these were higher than self ideals. And do you think that most Americans appreciate that idea?
No, I don't. I think there is still a huge disconnect between our service members and the rest of the country. They talk about this term that's commonly used, is the civilian military divide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, you've got less than 1% of our country that is putting on our nation's uniform. And, you know, so that you talk about your grandfather, my grandfather served in World War II as well. And my dad always shares, like, when my dad was a kid, his teacher was a veteran. Mm. His baseball coach was a veteran. The butcher was a veteran. Everybody was a veteran. Because in World War II, like, everybody was called to serve, right? Yeah. So they all served. So they all shared that kinship and that understanding of something bigger than themselves. And, you know, now we have an all-volunteer force, which is great. But when you have such a small population of people that are putting on this uniform, it's very easy to just turn a blind eye to, you know, that every single day there are men and women in every corner of the world, mm-hmm. Like protecting our mm-hmm. values and our way of life. Mm-hmm. And if you have no connection to that, it's very easy to just ignore that. And so, right.
Or take it for granted.
Yeah. But I always say, like, it's hard for me to put myself outside of that, because outside of just my brother serving, like I'm a military child, right? Like yeah. I was born into a military family. So it's all that I know.
Right.
But I also think that every single person has a responsibility to understand that and to pay attention to that. And I truly believe that if you do not serve, that's okay. There's so many ways to serve in our country. It doesn't have to be in the military, mm-hmm. but you have to have an understanding and appreciation for those that do put on this uniform. I think we have that obligation as American citizens.
I agree. And I think that, one other question that came to me when I was thinking about that is, like, what is something that we as a nation can do, or Americans, or people that are listening that haven't served, to better support and recognize the sacrifice and the service? Like, what would you like to see change in that way?
So, there's a couple things that I always say. I know, the veterans that are listening will probably say, no, we don't need that. But I always say, like, if I meet a veteran, I always, if I come across so many people and they'll say, oh yeah, I served. I was in the Marine Corps and I'm like, hey, thanks for your service. Where did you serve? Tell me about, like, engage people when you know that they served, mm-hmm. Outside of just saying thank you for your service, like, ask them questions, learn their story. Mm-hmm. And, the other thing that as a Gold Star sister, I always say, like, Memorial Day is an incredible time for us to learn the stories of those that have given their lives for this country. Yeah. And it's very easy. I think it was not last year, but 2 years ago, in the midst of COVID, Arlington Cemetery was closed. It was like, there was no outlets for you to be able to go out and learn stories. And I'm like, guys, just go on Google.
Yeah.
And Google, like, service members lost in Afghanistan, service members right. lost in Iraq, and go all the way back. It doesn't have to be from this conflict, but we should know those stories, because those stories, they're America's story. Mm-hmm. And each and every one of us should know the story of a fallen service member and be able to pass that story on. Mm-hmm. I work with thousands of Gold Star family members. And if you ask them, what is the one thing that you want for your loved one, overwhelmingly 99.999%, just all they say is, like, we don't want their name to be forgotten. We don't want their death to be in vain. We want people to know their story. Yeah. So if that's as little as you do, there are some Gold Star families of the fallen that look at Memorial Day as a very solemn, like, day. I'm all about throw on the burgers, grab the beer, have a great time. But guess what? When you're, like, popping the top off that beer and sitting next to your buddy, you say, hey, I want to tell you about Colby Umbrell, an Army first lieutenant that died in Iraq. Like, let me tell you his story. How incredible is this? So, like, we can do both, right? It doesn't have to be one or the other.
But we're sitting here popping a beer because of Corey's service, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the piece that I think that sometimes people forget, is that I think it's a beautiful privilege to be an American, and that it's not for free, right. And a lot of people. So yeah, I agree with you. And I'm super just honored to spend this time with you and thank your family, all of you, for your service. Like you said, your mom and everyone serves to make it all work. So it's really incredible. Before we kind of wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about identity and grief, because you mentioned that in your book. And I'm always curious about how people shape their identity, because I think it's a really important, especially when it comes to tragedy. And I think I see a lot of people become identified by their tragedy, right? By that becomes their identity. So in the communities that I serve, it might be that their child's illness is their identity, because it does. It becomes, you change your whole life because of it. It becomes all encompassing. You quit your job, and sometimes marriages don't make it. I mean, there's all these things that shift, right? But and similarly, I'm sure in your community as well. But I think that there's a really important component about resilience, like you talk about, that not just being identified by the tragedy, but by what you created from it. And I remember it was a family, it was from one of the school, it was Newtown, which happened not too long after Ethan died. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading an article. So I was really, these were, you know, 6 and 7 year olds. My son died when he was 7. I was super, like, I spent a lot of time out east for his care. So I just feel like it's second home to me out there. And so I was really engaged with that story. And a parent said, they said, you know, we want our kids to be remembered not for the tragedy that happened, but for what we created in the wake of it. Yeah. And I am like, that's what I believe we're here to do. So I just want you, if you could talk a little bit about that identity and how you were able to shift your identity from just, you know, Travis's death and the tragedy of his death to all that you've created. I mean, that's a personal choice, right? We have to make that choice.
Yeah. I mean, I know for me, and I'll say for my family too, I think I can speak for them. We did not want to be defined by Travis's death, but more by Travis's life. And so, like, when I talk about Travis, I want to talk about the things he did leading up to April 29th, 2007, not just April 29th, 2007. And I was really resigned to not be, I always say that, like, Gold Star families right now, like, if you think of a family of a fallen service member, you know, the image that will pop into your head is like the widow receiving the flag at the gravesite, or, you know, the mother bending over the coffin at Dover when the coffin comes in. Like, it's these very, like, solemn images of tragedy, and important for our public to see those images and understand the magnitude of that loss. But I want the images that follow to be the images of these families flying with me to Puerto Rico last week and rebuilding homes for in less than ideal conditions. Like, the strength of our Gold Star community is so much stronger than the tragedy that occurred. And so I made it a personal choice to say, like, I'm going to be not just the best version of myself, I'm going to be a better version of myself than I was, because I owe that to my brother. And there's a certain feeling that comes with losing someone in service to this country. Like, they voluntarily chose to put themselves in that situation to serve and protect us, me, you know? And so it was important to me to know that, like, after April 29, 2007, I had an obligation to live a life worthy of Travis's sacrifice. Yeah. Like, it wasn't about me, it was about him. It was about, like, I'm not going to dishonor him by pulling the covers over my head and wallowing in my grief. Because
he wouldn't have done that either.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think you can put that to every loss, not just, you know, not just a military loss. But, you know, when we lose someone, whatever the circumstances are, like, we want to be able to show them that, like, we're going to be strong for them, right? And we're going to move on for them. And, you know, grief is a shrewd beast. And I often will have people say to me, you know, I'm coming up on 15 years from the loss of my brother. And it's crazy because some days it feels like 15 years and then other days it feels like yesterday.
Yeah.
And people will, when they lose their loved ones, and I've had so many conversations that break my heart, and overwhelmingly people will say, well, when am I going to stop grieving? And I have to be brutally honest with them and tell them, like, you're not. But that's okay. But you have to know you're not. And for me, I don't ever want to stop grieving, because to stop grieving means to stop loving. Like, how can you ever stop grieving the loss of someone that meant so much to you? But you also can find a way to take that grief and let it channel you to do more, to be more. So I think that, you know, having that understanding of what grief is and the process that it is, and understanding that process from the beginning will help you plan for, you know, what your life looks like going forward.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that I spoke at an event, I think maybe Ethan, it was like 3 or 5 years after he died. And a mother came up to me, and her son had died 32 years before of a similar, you know, heart condition. And she was just, I mean, tear soaked, you know? And I got in my car, and honestly, I looked at my husband and I was like, oh shit. Yeah. I'm like, that's still going to be happening. Like, then, you know, and it was a super big realization for me that I wasn't going for a finish line, because I think at the time I thought, like, I'm going to figure this out and I, you know, but this is ongoing. And you wrote about that in your book. And I think it's super honest to say that. I think it's so true, but it's then that becomes even more like, then what are you going to do with it? Because that's how you experience joy and purpose and healing. Yeah, I totally agree. So just two more questions. You're running this like huge organization. I know you're a mom and you have other interests of your own, I'm sure. Like, how do you make it all go? I don't really think there's anything like balance. I'm not sure that exists in the world, but you're obviously very purpose-driven and mission-driven person. How do you like take rest, or how do you have boundaries, or like, how have you learned about that in your life?
I don't always have boundaries. And you're right. There is no balance. I find that like, I've gotten to a place where I know when I'm doing too much, right? Yeah. Like I can start to feel it. I feel it in my like anxiety, stress, like, and it starts to bubble, and where I used to try and like push through it. Mm-hmm. Now I've gotten to a place where I'm like, nope, time out. Like, we're going to go back to the basics, you know? Yeah. And I think it's really hard. You know, I've got three children, and I would say they are my number one priority, but I can say they're my number one priority. But when I put everything down on paper, it's like, you know, am I spending the time that I need to spend with my children?
Yeah.
And am I doing all the things that I need to be doing? I'm fortunate enough to have a husband who is basically Mr. Mom. And, you know, I realize how lucky I am to have that. And, you know, he supports probably most times better than I do. But I think the thing you have to think about is like, I always say you want to seize the moment of where you are. And so I'm someone that used to run so fast and so hard, I burnt myself out. Yeah. And you have to take that time to just say, all right, I've got to stop. I've got to slow down. That doesn't mean everything goes away, but I've just got to slow down. And I'm a big believer in lists. I will go to bed and I will pull my phone out. Like, it could be 1 a.m. And if I think of something, I'm on my phone in my notes section. Like, because if I'm more task driven with things, it makes things more accomplishable, and helps me to get through my day. I'm a big believer in physical activity. Mm-hmm. I know that I start to suffer and have mental decline when I'm not physically active.
Yeah.
When I am, and when I say physically active, like this summer, I did nothing but walk.
Yeah.
Like, and I've done everything from hardcore lifting to running multiple marathons. But this summer I said, I'm just going to walk. Like, mm-hmm. and I walked every single day. Sometimes I walked 1 mile a day. Sometimes I walked 10 miles a day. It just depends on how I felt. And I had never felt better than just mm-hmm. getting outside and walking. So when I talk about being physically active, like every single person can be physically active.
Yeah.
It's just about moving your body and like getting those endorphins going. I'm a huge believer in that science.
Yeah, same. And actually last summer I did the same. I walked a ton and I almost like, I had to get it in my head because I was like, this is wimpy. I should yeah. be running. I should be lifting. And when I was younger, if I was running, if I stopped for a second to tie my shoe, I had to stop my clock because I wasn't really working. Like I was just totally. Such a, that driven type of person. But I also felt the same. Like I felt so great walking. Like there's so much science behind it too, which I subsequently read, but I totally agree with you. So the last question I have for you is, what is a tool or piece of advice that has served you the best in becoming who you are today? Like what is something that just kind of sticks with you that this is how you are or who you are?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think one of the things, you know, as my organization has grown and I've had some, you know, I wrote this book, it did really well. I've had the opportunity to speak publicly in many different forums on, you know, a lot of cable news, and my story's been shared a lot. And I used to get really nervous about what people thought of me, right? Mm-hmm. And it was always this like if I could hear 100 positive things, but if I heard one negative thing, that just stuck with me.
Totally.
And that, you know, honestly was like my own lack of self-confidence and not believing in myself and what I was doing, and having a bigger belief in knowing that I was doing things for the right reasons, that I was sharing my story, my brother's story, for the right reasons. I used to just worry about that 1% that thought I was doing things for the wrong reasons. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a friend of mine, actually, I had conversations with him about it. He was a Marine that served with Travis, and I shared that with him. And he's like, if you're going to spend time worrying about that one person, like you're never going to get where you want to be. And you're never, ever going to be able to, you know, be authentic, and vulnerable. And, you know, listen, I run my own podcast. There's so many times where I've said things where I'm like, oh my God, like I cringe at it. Yeah. But it's what I wanted to say, but I just worry like, I don't know if people are going to like that. And I've had to just like move past that and not let that get inside of me too much. And I think for me, you know, it's as simple as like, I don't care what you think. It's not that so much, but it's like, it's not listening to all the noise around you.
Yeah.
Like, believing in yourself enough that you're not listening to the noise around you, that you have this belief that like you're here for a purpose, you're here to do something, and you just got to keep going no matter what.
Right. And you're never going to get to that purpose or get to that if you're just constantly listening to the noise, right?
Yeah.
I love that. That's such great. So where can people find you if they want to know about more about you or the Travis Mannion Foundation? Where should they look?
Well, I'm probably most active on Instagram. It's my smallest following, but I love Instagram. So I'm R Mannion on Instagram, R Mannion on Twitter, Ryan Mannion on Facebook. But if I could guide anybody, my website is ryanmannion.com. But if I could guide anyone anywhere, it would be to learn more about the Travis Mannion Foundation and the work we're doing. And again, if you're someone who's inclined to serve a little bit and get more connected with your community, you can go to travismannion.org and join our mission.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Ryan, so much for spending this time with me. I loved learning about your story, and thank you to your family and to the entire veteran community for your service to our country and especially to Travis. It's an honor to be with you today. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining me here on the HeartStrong podcast. Please rate and review this podcast and share an episode that you love with a friend. And when you do, it helps us continue our mission of encouraging people to grow through the challenges in their lives. This podcast is brought to you by the Ethan Lindbergh Foundation and the HeartStrong Collective. To learn more about our work, please visit theheartstrong.com. We'll see you back here next week for another episode of the HeartStrong podcast.